Welcome to the Theater of Others podcast. My name is Adam Marple, and I'm the co-artistic director of the Theater of Others. With the COVID-19 pandemic forcing a shutdown and reevaluation of space and gathering, we at the Theater of Others are thinking about what stories we need and how best we can share them. We believe space is psychology, and it informs the way in which an audience interacts and reacts to what is presented to them. We create uniquely theatrical events in bespoke sensory performance spaces crafted to encourage curiosity and grant the audience permission to commune with the play. Now that that space has moved online, how can we encourage interaction and action amongst an audience virtually? The Theater Brothers produces plays that both welcome and challenge the audience. We are committed to international collaboration and are a laboratory that helps artists grow through intensive study of their craft. The Theater of Others creates a shared community of artists and audiences for the purpose of exploring the most profound issues of our lives and times. We believe the play watches the audience. The audience is necessary, and they are witness to what happens. And you get to be witness to us making that happen. The purpose of this podcast is to open up our process and let you in. We're peeling back the curtain, so to speak, and encouraging you to follow along, to ponder, prod, and question, to join us and criticize us if need be. Being a witness is no passive task, and it requires much from you. Are you up for the journey? On the podcast today, from Melbourne, Australia, are co-artistic directors Rudy Miller and myself in Cairo, Egypt. This podcast contains explicit language.
Don't plug out because he's got to, it's going to upload. Yep. Yeah.
Got it.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, Booty. please don't. Please don't do that.
Okay. I have my 7 o'clock in the morning voice. I'm just warming my folds up.
With your 100-day cough? You still have your 100-day cough?
Yeah, I still have my UK 100-day cough. It's horrible. Oof. It's very horrible. You look like you're cold as well. You're like stuffed up.
You know, you have the coldest house, or you did have the coldest house in Melbourne. I have the coldest house in Cairo. It is a refrigerator in my apartment because these buildings are built to keep the heat out. So I just am living inside of a refrigerator right now. I have long johns, I have pants, I have a sweater, I have a puffer vest on, and I'm still cold. It's so very, very cold in this apartment.
You have internet.
I do have internet. I'm in my bedroom. I don't know what the sound quality is like, but yes, I do have internet, and I'm on the podcast. It's like nothing has changed. It's great.
I woke up this morning and I just threw on the closest thing that I could find. I feel like I'm a little heavy-handed today.
This is a good shirt. We like this shirt.
Yeah, but I feel a little heavy-handed. Look at my hat. So, I just want people to know that there are going to be black people in the future and they're going to matter. In case you didn't know my politics, I just wanted to make sure that this is the tea.
Some people wear their heart on their sleeves. Some people wear their politics on their head and their chest.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Are there black people in Egypt?
There are black people in Egypt, yes.
I wonder
why. There are black people everywhere.
I think my brain is still waking up. I haven't had my I'm doing this whole like I'm going to do really great things for my body this year. You know.
I know. Resolution.
Yes, the not resolution resolution of setting goals for life change. My yoga, and I'm making these shakes every morning. And like, it's wonderful. I feel so like, you know who I feel like? I feel like Susan Powder. I feel like stopping the madness. I feel like Susan Powder. I feel like a combination of Susan Powder and, what's her name? Diane. Deborah, what's her name? You know, the woman who's like, she's like, okay, this is hip hop. You know, she's like doing the hip hop dance. She's teaching hip hop to all of us. It's like a 1980s video, and it's Donna.
Oh, yes.
Donna. She's like, no, let's see, in ballet, it's like this, but in hip hop, it's like this. And then I like to finish my dance with this, because that makes hip hop.
It's a known fact. Yes,
I feel like her, and Susan Powder, Stop the Madness. You know, remember Susan Powder? Oh, please tell me.
Nope. This is a name that you're just
please tell me
throwing out there.
Am I showing my age?
No.
I'm not throwing it out there. I'm introducing a woman that you've never heard of to your life. Susan Powder.
Okay.
She was like, she weighed like 900 pounds.
Okay.
And then she stopped the madness and started eating well and got her body together and became this like fitness guru. And she was like, do you know who Wayne Brady is?
Of course I know who Wayne Brady is.
Okay, good. So do you remember when Wayne Brady had a talk show?
For like a brief minute, yes.
Do you know why it was a brief minute?
Why?
Because he had Susan Powder as a guest.
Oh, she was the reason he no longer had the show.
All I have to say is, after Susan Powder became a guest, he was canceled. Because Susan Powder is unedited. And she was like talking about Dr. Phil. And why was Dr. Phil like giving like health advice? She's like, he's fat. she was like so harsh. So I'm feeling like that. I'm feeling like Susan Powder and Donna. I feel like Donna Powder.
Okay.
That's my drag name.
Donna I'm looking Powder. Her up right now. I'm just looking her up to see. I've never seen this person in my life.
She's amazing. Okay. Susan Powder's amazing. You know why I like her? Because she says what she wants to say. And she's wild. She's wild. You know, and it's interesting because when I was still living, no, we weren't living in New York. We were, because it was Tazakshe, we were living in Singapore because Akshay was, it was like right when I met Akshay, like the end of, like the very beginning of our relationship, when I brought him to America, we went and saw this show, Next to Normal. And it was in previews. And it was incredible. And the lead character was wild because of her illness. I don't think Susan Powder is like that, but the lead character was amazing. And oh my God, she blew the house down, and it was only previews. This is the thing about Broadway. Like previews are like previews because they can see if they make little changes, but they still throw it down. Like the same thing happened to me when I watched Color Purple, like Cynthia Erivo blew it out of the park. This is a great thing, y'all. If you can't afford Broadway, get to those previews because they throw it down. And then I had never seen a show that actually dealt with this kind of content so beautifully. And the music, baby, the music. Oh, don't even get me going on the music. Do not. Okay.
Well,
but you know who I'm going to get going on the music?
I think I should. Well, yes.
Do you know who I'm going to get going on the music?
Yes, of course.
Ladies and gentlemen, and non-binary conforming individuals, we have an amazing guest today. We have an extraordinary guest today, and we're so excited because we know nothing about this topic. So we are going to be learning just like you. Please welcome to the stage the consummate, the extraordinary, the award-winning, Tony Award-winning, Pulitzer Prize Drama Award winning, Emmy Award winning, Outer Critics Circle Award winning, Drama Desk Award winning, Grammy Award winning, Tom Kitt. Yay! Welcome, Tom. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
We're so happy to have you here. Oh my God.
It's so
happy because we to see and see Tanvi is our musical theater princess of the company. And Adam and I, we are laymen when it comes to musical theater. I'm an audience member. Adam's a grumpy frau in the corner going, "Why are we watching a musical?" And I'm the one in the front row crying and screaming and going, "Oh my God." So welcome, please educate us.
You're right. Yeah, no easy task there. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, in an hour. I have a question, Tom. I have a question, sir.
Yeah.
Tell me, because clearly this is your genre and you love it. Why do you love it so much? What is it? Because because I'm going to say this. You touch material in such an amazing way, and I'm going to tell you why I'm saying this. And I've said it many times in this podcast, and Adam is my witness, I love, absolutely love Patrick's song to SpongeBob when he's missing his best friend. I cried. Tom, I can't tell you how deeply I cried from that song, from the silly musical, but that song hit me so deeply. It still moves inside of me. So please tell us why.
You know who wrote that song, right?
Who wrote
it? I wish I wrote that song. Who wrote that
song?
That's John
Legend. Oh my God. Oh my God. So good. Tom.
Yeah. I got to orchestrate it and arrange it, which I was very fortunate to do, but that's a beautiful, beautiful song. I'm with you on that.
Y'all killed that song. And then that song comes out and it's like, why am I crying like this? What is this?
You know, John sent that song to us because when I was working on SpongeBob, if you look at the group of artists who wrote songs for SpongeBob, it's quite extraordinary. And we would get materials in many different forms. Some of them were demos that were produced. Some of them were demos that they just kind of seemed to do, you know, a scratch demo at the piano. And I think John Legend was on tour and he found this moment of time when he was able to sneak away. And there was just a rawness to this demo he sent. It almost sounded like he was in a basement somewhere, had just done two shows and just kind of, there was something about the rawness and emotion that he brought in the state that he was in that made it even more impactful when you heard it. And I couldn't stop listening to that demo because it told you everything that you needed to know about the song. And I just wanted to support it and kind of get out of the way of it too, because it doesn't need me. I mean, it's just such a glorious composition.
Y'all killed it. And that was where I was like, oh my God, this is why theater is so cool. So why musical theater? Tell me why specifically music? Because it's a very specific genre and those are your people. Talk to us about it.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Did you know that you can change what you taste by what you hear? How can you use sound to make a deeper connection with your clients? Can we be healed with sound? Sound influences people in their buying decisions and their daily lives. In the podcast Audio Branding, I explore all of this, both with my own observations as a voice actor of over 15 years and by interviewing knowledgeable professionals in the field of advertising, marketing, music, and science. To have a listen for yourself, visit audiobrandingpodcast.com.
Well, it's a couple of things. At an early age, I studied the piano, discovered the piano at the age of four, and I found that I have something called perfect pitch, which basically means that you can hear a note and you know what it is. And it's just something I think you're born with. So it allowed me to play by ear very easily. I didn't know why I was able to. I kind of describe it as the memorization of sound. I memorized what these notes sound like, and I can use music in that way. So I started playing classical music and started to write music. And then I began to dream of being a singer-songwriter, a recording artist. And when I got to college, I met Brian Yorkey, with whom I wrote Next to Normal. And for the first time, started to write for the theater. And what I loved about it was, one, being able to write outside of myself, to write for other voices, vocal arrangements. And then the other thing is to use that art form to tell a story. Now, we all have gone to musicals where we've been entertained. We've seen incredible artistry. But when you see a musical about a subject matter that you didn't expect, and it not only entertains you, but it kind of has an impact and kind of wrecks you in emotion the way you would if you saw a play or you saw a film. That was something new that I encountered, and that made me want to write for the musical theater even more, because I wanted to try and write those kinds of shows that have an unexpected emotional impact on an audience.
May, I'm so glad you said that, because that has been my problem, issue, consistent joke on this podcast, is musicals can be entertaining. There can be a lot of artistry, but very little that I have ever seen or come across has been about storytelling that's impactful, about a subject matter that a subject that matters. And that's what I felt was different about Next to Normal. I don't like a lot of musicals, but I loved Next to Normal because it was like, oh, this is just a play with music. I mean, the music is very important to the play, but this, I've never seen a topic like this in a musical. Usually it's like, I want a hot dog. I want a hot dog today. And it's like, I don't care. Like, why are they singing? It doesn't make any sense to me. But what I've really loved about that, and I saw that in Singapore, was that it really did. It floored me. And I'm not just saying that because I don't normally like musicals. But looking at like the stuff that you've done, it's such a different way of going about of doing musicals. I'm just so excited to actually talk to somebody that is doing it, because yeah, I can finally put up my curmudgeonly ways about musical theater, hopefully. Tom's been working on me for years, so.
Well, I do love all musicals. And going back to what you led with about being able to educate about musicals, the truth is that the more you do them, the more you realize you don't know. Each one of them that you encounter and take on is difficult and challenging in its own way. And when I, when Brian and I were at the BMI Musical Theater Workshop, one thing that we did was we studied librettos, not even just scores, but looking at the way musicals are structured, classic form. There's a craft to it. And no matter what subject matter, no matter what style of musical, there is a craft to it to figure out how the story that you're telling is going to work for you. And the truth is, like, I want to work on big musical comedies that, that lift you in a certain way. You know, it's wonderful to be able to just do a varied amount, do varied works as an artist. But when we were at BMI, they used the term breaking the mold. And I think that for all art forms, when someone does something that you haven't seen before, when you didn't realize an art form could do a certain thing, that's when the needle moves. And we were all aspiring, I should say, to do that. It's never for one artist to say that I have done that, because I know there are people, and I'm so happy to hear your passion for Next to Normal. There are going to be people who love Next to Normal and people who don't love Next to Normal. But I know that for Brian and I, we conceived of that piece because we wanted to try something different. We wanted to tell a story that you didn't expect to find in the theater. And I'll never forget in previews when a teenager who has bipolar disorder approached us after the show had ended and said, I want to thank you for the show, because now I have something I can show my friends that illustrates what I'm dealing with. And I thought, whatever happens, that's everything, because art has moved over into comfort and informing someone's life. And I know for me, that's what made me want to be an artist. Work that brought out those feelings in me, that made me feel like someone sees the way I'm feeling and is speaking to the human experience in a way that's not only impactful, but I'm learning.
I love this. I have two questions. First, can you, because I'm dyslexic, and can you tell us what BMI is, so our listeners know what BMI is?
Yes. So BMI and ASCAP are publishing entities. Basically, when you're an artist, you are affiliated with one of these organizations who basically looks after your compositions. And when your work is being performed in the world, basically this houses your compositions. But they both have wonderful workshops where artists can go and they can study the craft of songwriting in some way. And BMI specifically has one geared towards musical theater artists. It's called the Lehman Engel Musical Theater Workshop. When I was there, we were there with other writers such as Amanda Green, who wrote Hands on a Hard Body and Mr. Saturday Night and is a good friend of mine, Curtis Moore and Tom Miser, who are currently writing songs for The Marvelous Miss Maisel. And Bobby Lopez, Jeff Marks, who wrote Avenue Q, and Bobby, who is since, and also Kristen Anderson Lopez was in the workshop a few years after us, but of course, Bobby and Kristen, Frozen, and Coco, and Book of Mormon, and for Bobby, I should say. And so anyway, the list there, and that's just the year I was in. So there are many incredible artists who have come through the BMI Musical Theater Workshop. And it really is a wonderful place to develop your craft. You get assignments that are challenging. Next to Normal actually was an assignment to write a 10-minute musical.
And, fantastic, because that's a great segue, because I'm going to ask you the next thing. Yes, great.
Yeah, so that's where it started. It started as a 10-minute musical exploration that so got inside of us, we just felt like we had to keep writing songs for it, and unexpectedly it became a full production. But anyway, that's what the BMI Musical Theater Workshop is.
Fantastic. So let's go into Next to Normal, because as makers ourselves, and we talk about this often, of like, how do you start a project? Because, you know, people see the final product, but they don't know how many years it's taken to make it. They don't know how many edits you've gone through and how many no's you've received before they actually get to see it. Walk us through your journey with Next to Normal, because it's such a special play, and we would love to hear how that even began.
Well, I should start by saying Next to Normal probably is not the typical experience. And I think that your debut album never is. It just kind of happens. Pushing that boulder up the hill. But it did come out of this 10-minute musical exercise that Brian and I just didn't want to put down and kept working on. And we went backwards. We wrote a bunch of songs initially before we outlined and did the proper treatment. So we ended up with a lot of songs that we really couldn't use when we started to hone the story. But I would say for the first 4 years, from 1998 to 2002, we were writing songs. We were hosted by the Village Theater in Issaquah, Washington, to do a workshop. And then it all culminated in a concert version of the show at the Cutting Room in July of 2002, at which point Brian and I walked away from it for a couple of years. We came back to it thanks to the Jonathan Larson Foundation and, again, Village Theater. Village Theater applied to the Larson Foundation for a grant on the show's behalf. We were given that grant, and that led to a new workshop where we then got into the New York Musical Theater Festival, which is where Second Stage and David Stone saw the show and then came aboard. And then David, of course, after the Second Stage production, received mixed response. David brought the show down to Arena Stage so that it could come back to Broadway, which at that time was a very atypical way to go. But that was 11 years all told, from 1998 when we first wrote that 10-minute musical to the Broadway production, stops and starts. And I can't tell you how many angels there were who just kept saying to Brian and I, keep going, you're onto something, and we'll support you however we can.
11 years.
11 years, yeah. worth every year, right?
Yes, 100%. 100%. And so let's keep talking about these 11 years. So tell us about the artist that was moving through those 11 years.
So I started writing the show when I was 24. I was supporting myself through musical directing. I was doing concerts. The record label Ghostlight was called Chickaboom at that time. And I got involved musical directing concerts, of great Broadway artists like Sherry Renee Scott and Adam Pascal and the Broadway Inspirational Voices. And that would lead to gigs getting musical director work. So I was able to support myself. I was also playing piano bar three nights a week, teaching piano lessons. And actually Amanda Green, who I met in the BMI workshop, I started working with Amanda as her musical director, and we started writing High Fidelity. That was my first Broadway show. So High Fidelity happened in 2006, and 11 days later it closed. So it was a big flop that sits on the wall of Joe Allen, one that I'm incredibly proud of. But that was hard to go through. And my son, my first son, was born in 2005. So here I am, the father of an 18-month-old, and suddenly I have to go back to work and figure out what I do after my big show flop that I thought was going to give us some ease. So here's Next to Normal. That's the next show. It's very hard, as you can imagine, to be writing a show like Next to Normal, having a young son as you're seeing fatherhood, how it's so Next to Normal has always been, while it's not autobiographical, you can't help, if you're writing about something so human, to have your own life seep into the writing and your perspective on writing, on being part of that show. So, so that show kept sort of surviving the stops. And I guess Michael, my older son, was four. My wife, was pregnant with our second, and the C-section was scheduled for opening night on Broadway. And we asked if we could delay it. The pictures of opening night are my wife dancing, full on pregnant. And then a week later, we had Julia. So it's kind of an amazing time. But, you know, the 24-year-old to the 35-year-old who opened that show on Broadway, there was a lot of growth. There was a lot of resilience I had to find. I went through a lot. But the truth is, 35 to I'm about to turn 50, there's as much growth.
Baby, 50s are good. 50s are good. Come on. Join me. Join me. They're good, baby. You'll be okay.
I love it. I love it. So a life in the theater is a constant life of challenge, discovery. You do it because you love it. I've listed my shows, and you would have never thought Next to Normal would be one of the most successful based on some titles that had already achieved something and thought maybe they would be, you know, more safe commercial bets. You know, I've done everything in my career because of a passion to do it, no matter what. Mm. But it says a lot that Next to Normal, this little show that could, managed to find its way. And for anyone out there, always write the thing that's speaking to you most. Don't let anybody tell you what to write and what not to write. If you feel passionate about something and you see a way through it, then you have to take it on and discover it.
I love that, because it's really exciting to hear such a successful artist talk about, and you just keep doing it. I had babies and I'm at the piano bar and I'm teaching piano. Like, I'm an artist. Like,
you figure it out. You figure it out.
You can have babies and still be broke and trying to make the ends meet. And, you know, you know,
exactly right.
And Tom, I tell you that the writing for the relationship between the husband and wife and Next to Normal is incredible. That relationship, mate, is so.
Well, I have to give that to Brian. Brian is an extraordinary writer, and the show always was something that was speaking to him. He pitched me the idea. So the nuance he found, the true humanity in the show, even now, I was back in the UK in the summer for the Donmar production. It was the debut of the show in the UK, and it's transferring to the West End this summer. And it was so amazing to be back 15 years later after we opened on Broadway, hearing the show anew with new artists. One of the actors came up to me and said that they were very young when they saw the show on the Tony Awards, and they said, I have to be in that show one day. And now they are. I mean, talk about feeling old in that moment. It was a great moment.
Exactly.
Nonetheless. Mm-hmm. But you know, it means the world that the show continues to be out there, and it's become global. There's so many families around the world that have been the Goodman family, and that means the world to Brian and I.
What? But But why bipolar disorder? Was there someone in your family, or what was the opening for that?
It's a really good question. You know, it's more, it kind of came with Brian's pitch, I believe. And I know that he had been researching and he had seen something on the news about shock treatment. It was the kind of like wow moment, as it is in the show, when you realize that shock treatment is something that is highly effective and is in practice. So it was researching what kind of cases might bring upon that kind of treatment, I believe.
Ah, wow. That's great. I mean, because that's already confronting, you know, shock treatment is that's confronting. So they still give shock treatment today.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't been in the research in quite a bit, but yes. And I remember at the time we were talking about it, there was at that point, I think an 80% success rate of the treatment. And there also was not necessarily a clear cut reason why it worked. Now that was years ago. So it all might have changed, but though that I seem to remember from when we were first talking about it.
Wow. That's wild. That's wild.
Yeah.
So SpongeBob, let's talk about SpongeBob because the Patrick song, you know, is my song. We have to talk about SpongeBob, y'all. I'm sorry, Adam. We're talking about SpongeBob. I know you. So Adam knows Tina.
Oh, really?
I know Tina well, yes. And I know you've done two shows with her, right? Is that correct?
Yes, I've done SpongeBob. And then there was a musical adaptation of a beautiful film with Kevin Kline from the 90s called Dave.
Dave, yeah. I love that. I love the film, yeah.
That was in Washington, D.C. just before the pandemic. I'm hoping that we'll get back to it soon. But those are the two shows.
So, Tom, why SpongeBob? Why does it need to be on Broadway?
SpongeBob, well, you know, I'm a fan. SpongeBob makes me laugh hysterically. I remember sitting in a hotel room with my son watching one of the movies, and the two of us were cackling and crying. So the idea of getting pulled into a world of animation and thinking what that was going to be possible in terms of what kind of music was going to be in the show and I was going to get to do, but also it was pitched to me that it was being written by a number of extraordinary artists, and I was going to get a chance to collaborate. So you have, as I mentioned, John Legend, you have Yolanda Adams, Plain White Tees, Aerosmith. I mean, it was incredible, and that's just a few of them. So I was looking forward to that experience. And then what Tina did, and then Tina I knew was also attached, and I'd always wanted to work with Tina Landau. And what Tina does is she takes this source material and she makes it have an impact and have a message and something to say in a way that you don't expect. And it took audiences a bit to walk into that room and understand that, oh, I'm going to have an emotional experience at this show. And they truly did. My kids loved it. My wife loved it. And they kept talking about how inventive, how what it had to say. I just loved being immersed in that world. So yes, definitely for someone of a fan of the material coming in and then getting a chance to see where we could push it in terms of having something to say in the moment, I'm really proud of it.
How much support did you get in getting it up on in Broadway? Was there a big support, or did you have to do as much work as you did with Next to Normal?
Well, it's different because in doing it, you of course already have Viacom, Nickelodeon, who was going to be supporting this. So I walked into something that was already in motion, and then I got a chance to see what had already been in place. But again, the making a musical makes everybody earthbound, and you see how much time, how much development, and I can't say enough about our producers. Everybody went, went to the umpteenth to be able to like make SpongeBob happen in the right way. We had a wonderful out of town experience. So and as I say, any musical is challenging, and we got all the support we needed.
I love it. So so for us laymen, can you tell us what goes into producing a Broadway musical? Like, if I've got a if I've got a musical and I was like, I wanted to go to Broadway, what do I have to expect?
Well, that's a really good question. I would say that in terms of producing a musical, of course, there comes the idea and you have to put the team together. And usually the team will involve, if it's a musical, you have your book, music and lyrics. It could be three people. It could be two people. It could be one person. And then you have your director. And that's sort of your core creatives. And then, of course, there's important aspects of choreography. There's your music team. And then there's the designers. There's lighting. There's sets. There's costuming. So it's a full team of people that have to put something like that together. And then as a producer, it's looking at the trajectory and saying, okay, what's going to give us the best chance to succeed? So you have to look at costs. You have to look at what is the budget going to be? What's the scale of all of the work? How long do we think the development process is going to be? What's the scope of the music and what kind of band might that need to be? And then do we go out of town? Do we look at a town tryout? There are these wonderful theaters that are launching pads to come to Broadway. Do we look for a non-for-profit in New York? Maybe that's what Next to Normal did with Second Stage. So maybe we start in New York and see if we can ride the momentum. I'm involved with the new Alicia Keys musical, Hell's Kitchen, and that show started at the Public in the fall, and now it's moving to Broadway this spring. So that's an example of a non-for-profit moving to Broadway. The truth is, there are many ways you can go about it, and most important is that you give your show and whatever its subject matter and whatever kind of audience it needs to build, you give it the best chance to get momentum that can bring it into Broadway. And then when you're on Broadway, who knows? It's just, I've been through it so many times. Thankfully, luckily, I've been through it so many times, and I've had a wide variety of experiences in terms of how long something can run. And of course, having the pandemic in the middle of trying to make shows and coming back from that. So there's just, you expect the unexpected, but at the end of the day, as I was talking about with Next Normal, you lead with your heart, you lead with your passions and make something that you're desperate to make.
So go ahead, Adam.
I was going to ask.
Full of questions. Go ahead, Adam.
No, I know you are. And so whenever I have a question, you know, it's got to be something that's burning on my mind. As composer, I imagine the same as a playwright, you have to hand it over at some point and trust that the music director or whoever is going to be taking over is going to be doing that. But are you still in the room while that is happening? Are you going to rehearsals? Are you having conversations afterwards? Are you tweaking the score as you go until all the way through previews? Like where do you start to back away from the project, or where do you still hold on?
The answer to that is all of the above. Yes. And so for me as a composer, I put a lot of detail into the way I score just the music for what we call a piano vocal. And a piano vocal is it has the piano accompaniment and it has all of the vocal lines. If it's a solo, it'll have the one vocal line. If it's a duet or a trio, or it has a vocal arrangement, all those vocals will be represented. But basically it allows you to rehearse and present the material with just a piano. You might put chords in it so a guitarist could read along if the music warrants that. And also usually a drummer can read from the PV and see the rhythm in the left hand and be able to play along as well if you need that. So it's very, very useful. And in the piano vocals that I write, I put a lot of thought into my voicings on the piano so that an orchestrator, someone coming to the music, will see where I'm pushing the tonality of the composition. That's just the way that I like to work and give as much detail as I can. What it also allows me to do is step out of the room if I need to be working on something else, if I'm orchestrating the work as well, so I can feel confident that the cast and the music team has all of the information that they're going to need if I'm not in the room. And if there are questions, they can ask them. And then, of course, as you're rehearsing, questions will come up, thoughts will come up. Someone might say, the director, for example, you know, this is feeling a bit long. Can we look at a cut? There's something about the accompaniment that doesn't feel right here. It's feeling a little slow. So yes, always evolving all the way through previews. We have a term which is freezing the show. And freezing the show means that you are done working. You are saying, this is the final version. Actors don't have to worry about any more changes coming at them. And usually you do that strategically on Broadway at a time where the cast and company has a few shows to do without any changes, so that then they present it comfortably and confidently for critics. So you freeze the show usually three days before your first critics performance.
So can you talk about that? Can you talk about what is a critics performance and what are previews for our audience?
So previews, which are extremely important and illuminating, I should say, it's the first time you put the show in front of an audience, and you do it with some safety for the process because you work through previews. So let's say you have a preview on a Tuesday night, you have an audience, and you get some information. There's a number that's been in the show for years, you've seen it at readings, and then suddenly you're expecting it to be a big success and the audience is lukewarm towards it. So at the end of that preview, you say, hey, I watched the show, I noticed something in this number, I want to put in a change, can we do that for tomorrow? And you plan out, so then that next day, Wednesday, you walk in, and you have new music, and you have new script pages, and you talk through the change, and then you put it on stage, and you tech it, and you rehearse it, so that that change can go into the show that evening. So what I like to say is, there are many preview audiences seeing that version of the show for the very first time, because usually something new has gone in. Now, weekends are, you don't rehearse for the most part, so those usually are locked, and a show won't change between Friday and Sunday. But when you come back Tuesday, you keep working on it. So over the course of previews, 1, 2, 3 weeks, depending on the length, you will be putting in changes. When you get to that special moment of freezing the show, those are still previews. The show hasn't opened yet, but now previews are critic performances. So they're still technically previews, but that's the night that you have the critics coming. And usually they span 4 shows, maybe sometimes 5. And then you have your official opening, and that's when then the next day you'll see the reviews come out. And then, but that's the opening night. The opening night is kind of the end of that process. And then hopefully you get to run a really long time.
How long do previews usually run?
They can go anywhere from, I would say, 3 to 5 weeks.
Five weeks. Usually, wow, okay.
I mean, in rarer cases, I think the average is probably somewhere in the 3 to 4 week period.
Wow.
Next to normal, we moved from arena stage to Broadway. I don't think that because we weren't making a ton of changes, I feel like our preview process was on the shorter side. So it just depends on the show's trajectory and also how many bells and whistles, are happening. And so you may want to build in more tech, more previews, because if you make changes and you have a big show with a big set, it might take longer to be able to put in everything you want.
So here's my question. What's your favorite musical of all time? And
come
why?
On, you can't, that's which child do you like the most?
I didn't
that's,
hear. You can tell, but that's why I said why. That's why I said why.
Here's how I can answer that question. I can answer that question by telling you what's the musical that I remember having the kind of impact that pushed me into doing this.
Okay.
And it's one of my favorites. It's an easy one for me to say because it has such an effect on me to this day, is Into the Woods. And Into the Woods.
Same!
I performed in it in high school. I was Cinderella's prince and the wolf. And at that point, again, I wasn't necessarily looking to have a career in the theater. And I just remember being completely blown away from beginning to end of that process. And all of us couldn't wait to talk about our characters and what the themes meant for the real world, how the show was speaking on so many levels. It was just like a masterclass. And the sort of the end of that story is that coming out of the pandemic, my wife, who is an arts educator, she is the drama chair for a theater program in a high school. And the show that she brought the students back with was Into the Woods. And both my older son and my daughter were in the show. And I wept the entire time. But it was the end of the first act, the beautiful contrapuntal, that was fearful, that was deep, that was dark, and that was fearful, right? And that's where I lost it the most, because I remembered being an 18-year-old and hearing that music ricochet all around me and realizing what musical theater had the power to do. And I actually got to write because I was lucky enough to get to know Stephen Sondheim and of course James Lapine, who I my collaborator on Flying Over Sunset. I was able to write both of them and tell them that experience that I had in the theater and what that work meant to me. And Stephen Sondheim wrote me back and said, it always means a great deal when a writer's work impacts you. Thank you for sharing. It was just like great to get to be the 18-year-old again, but get to tell my heroes what their work meant to me. So that's an easy answer for me.
I agree with you. I'm on the same boat. My song is "You're So Nice, You're Not Good, You're Not Bad, You're Just Nice." That song like shaped me for life. I was the witch.
No more does it for me. The whole father-son thing.
It just gets yes.
me. What can I say?
Yeah, and you know the part of No More that gets me the most is please. When he says please. Like
it's father, like son.
Please.
Like father, like son. Yeah. Even talking about it makes me tear up a little bit.
It's so good.
I took my children to see the film and I was crying like mm-hmm. crazy. And they looked at me like, what is wrong with our father? But it was good for them to see
the Bernadette Peters version. They have to see the Bernadette Peters version. That's the one that's just like, her witch is like, oh, that's incredible. Okay. Sorry, Adam.
sorry, Tom. This is the one that I can't do because it's written in a way to get stuck in my head. Especially, I just can't. So I love Sondheim. I love all of his. I love all of his work. Otherwise, but that's the one that I boycott. So I love that you all.
When it comes to music.
It really is.
What happens to him is that the music gets stuck in his head, and it just goes over and over and over and over and over again. Yeah.
That was a superpower. That's a superpower that I have is I don't have perfect pitch, but like I hear it once and I know it. I can't read music, but like my entire life with chorus and voice and things like that, I just need to hear.
Maybe you do have those skills and you just don't know because you haven't trained in it. But my brother has perfect pitch.
He
can't use it. And I want to say to him, you're a waste of perfect pitch. There are all these people who would love to have it.
Amen.
You don't do anything with it.
Yeah, maybe.
I think we need to pursue this, Adam. I want to get you. We need a perfect pitch in the house. I want a perfect pitch all my life.
I really did think it was something that anybody could learn by studying an instrument for a long time, but it really is something that's part of you. I don't know how it's connected, but it just is.
Well, look, I think we need to go on a break because I could be here all day and we're going to have to ask you to come back, Tom. When you open your next show, we'll bring you back. That'd be so good. Let's take a break and then come back with some provocations. How's that sound, boys?
Let's do it.
Excellent.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen and non-binary conforming individuals, you are listening to the stereo sounds of JDB. Jack David Burmester. Wow, Jack, are you trying to get a job with Tom? What kind of composition is that?
You're auditioning? Whoa. What is going on with that composition, Jack?
So, Adam, can you let Tom know about what this provocation world is all about?
Yeah, so you've lit everybody who's listening to this on fire. You've inspired them. You've got them thinking about following their passion with whatever they're writing about and having an eclectic style of things. What questions would you leave with them, or what provocations would you leave to the audience of read this, watch this, go see this, do this thing, for people who are excited about this type of work or just work in general, that you as an artist, you are excited about right now?
Well, I guess the thing that I would say, and this comes from the parent in me, raising three children and knowing what it is to be an artist and to dedicate yourself to something that you need stillness. You need space to be able to really experience. And, you know, it's not for me to say, this is the book you should read, or this is the thing that you should see, because it differs for everybody. We all have such different tastes and different things that we seek out. But I think the thing that I would say is, what is that space for you in a world right now that's filled with so much noise, and it's so easy to get swept up in all the screens that we have? And I just keep telling my own kids to make sure that you have stillness, to find something that makes you think about the world, think about what you want to put into the world, what you want to get from the world. How do you find a way to kind of slow your senses to a place where you can, even if you're not a composer, even if you're not a writer, but what it takes to sit at the piano and write a piece of music, it takes concentration. It takes a kind of keeping out of the world and staying in something that at times can be really easy and at times can drive you kind of crazy, but you see a goal. You see the ability to put something into the world that didn't exist however many seconds, minutes, days ago. So I look at people, great instrumentalists who spent hours studying and practicing. And I worry that in the world right now, with a kind of instant gratification of what we can get online and what we can get on our phones, what it means to sit there by yourself and be able to tell yourself that you are doing something important, that you are feeding your soul, that you are sitting with something that is challenging and is kind of altering the way that you think, and it makes you want to evolve and be curious. I want to keep growing. I don't want to be the person that I am today in however many years. I want to have learned new things and be trying new things, and I may fail, but have the courage to try. And so I just implore everybody out there, whatever that is for you, whatever is going to feed your soul, whatever is going to allow you to find stillness and to find a sense of spirituality, and to surround yourself with people who will say to you, yes, you should write next to normal. Yes, no, that's going to be challenging. But if that's what's speaking to you, that's what you should be doing. That's, I think, the great challenge for all of us right now.
Wow. I'm going to cry, Tom. You're so beautiful. I want you to be my dad.
That Daddy. Is my question and provocation.
That is amazing. That's so beautiful. I think people are probably crying listening to that, because it's like, it's just good to be reminded to just be still. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let it come to you.
Listen to a piece really of music. There's nothing better than putting on a piece of music that you've never heard before and just having it wash over you and discover something new about tonality, about harmony. It's what I love about Sondheim, because that kind of music, yeah. It's just something I haven't heard before. And I call it the beautiful dissonance, right? You have to work always, at it a little bit. But to understand it and to take it in is to be transformed in some way. And whatever that music is for everybody out there, I know everyone feels it in a certain way. There's that moment where you cannot wait to say to someone, I have to play you something. You know, you have to find that for right. all facets of your life.
Right. What are you listening to these days?
Mm-hmm. What am I listening to? It's a really good question. You know, actually, Brian Yorkey just suggested an album by a band called Boy Genius that I put on recently, and it kind of floored me. It's a beautiful sort of anthemic rock album, but has glorious harmonies and just beautiful writing. So that's the most recent thing. But it will span different genres. I love listening to classical music. I'll just put on a station in the morning and just listen and hear strains of things here and there.
What do you think of Philip Glass?
I like Philip Glass. I like minimalist. I like I mean, there's a just like, and the more I listen to, the more I hear the wide range, but I'm definitely a fan.
That's Adam's favorite, so I just had to ask. Yeah.
Thanks, Booty. Thanks. I see where you're going with that. Yeah.
Adam Marple, how do we know that these people are going to do these things? This provocation is exceptional.
Yes, it's great provocation. And the way that they're going to know that they've done this is they're going to go to speakpipe.com/theaterofothers. Again, speakpipe.com/theaterofothers, theater with an R-E, theater of others, all one word. Leave a 90-second voice message on there. We'll play it on air. If you don't want your lovely voice to be heard, but you do want to chime in, you can send it to podcast@theaterofothers. We are also on Instagram, Facebook, and our website. But the only way they're going to know if we have amazing guests like Tom on again is if they do what, Booty?
Subscribe. You got to subscribe if you want us to come to your inbox every week. We come to your inbox every week, y'all, for 3 years, 5 seasons every week. Why aren't you have not subscribed yet? I don't know what's going to make you subscribe. Maybe if you want to give us 5 stars, like my Uber driver, you give me 5 stars, I give you 5 stars. Five stars. It's a win-win. It's a win zero sum the game up.
Yep. Yep. Nothing wrong with that sentence.
And then if you really like us, you can leave us a comment. Like if you're like, oh my God, this podcast is so good, I want to give them 5.1 stars, but I can't give them 0.1 stars. You can put it in the comments. Put it in the comments. It goes into the algorithm. And then all of a sudden, we are not only the top 5% podcast in the world, we are in the top 1% podcast in the world. And you know who comes. You know who's going to come within the top 1%, Adam. Who's coming if we come in the top 1%?
Oprah.
Yes, exactly. Oprah will be on here. When we become the top 1%, it's a known fact. And you know if we get Oprah, he's going to come next. Yeah. You know who's coming next if we get Oprah.
I do.
Beyonce. Yes. Beyonce. The Virgo. We get the Virgo. Yes. And then, of course, Michelle Obama. Yes, Michelle Obama will be here as well. She's already on the list.
She's RSVP'd. She's RSVP'd. She's just waiting for Oprah.
And I'll make sure I wear my merch. I'll wear a reminder that I'm a black man.
In case they didn't know. In case they were concerned.
In case they didn't know.
Tom, I don't know about that booty. I'm on the fence about him.
Thank you so much for coming and playing with us and having a conversation with us. I know for a fact that our listeners are going so crazy for this conversation we had. Absolutely. You've shared so much of yourself this past hour. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yay. Will you come back if we ask you back?
Of course. Absolutely.
I love it. Adam, I love you too.
I love you, Booty.
I'll see you next week.
Always.
And everyone else will be in your inbox next week. Bye!
Thanks for joining us this week on the Theater Brothers podcast. Make sure to visit our website, theaterbrothers.org, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or via RSS, so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. A special thank you to Purple Planet for the music you've heard. The Theater Brothers creates a shared community of artists and audiences for the purposes of exploring the most profound issues of our lives and times. We believe the play watches the audience. The audience is necessary, and they are witness to what happens. And you get to be witness to us making that happen. The purpose of this podcast is to open up our process and let you in. We're peeling back the curtain, so to speak, and encouraging you to follow along, to ponder, prod, and question, to join us and criticize us if need be. Being a witness is no passive task and requires much from you. Are you up for the journey? Be sure to tune in next week for our next journey.